Hello and welcome to another edition of Editing Aloud. My name is Sime Izake. With me at the desk today are Tiseso, Asha, as well as Patrick. We're going to be taking a look at some of the key stories over the last while. So I want to start off by looking at the G20. Asha, you attended there with the who's from the political and business sphere. What is your sense of what happened there? Did you by any chance see the whole Ivanka Trump trying to get into, conversation with world leaders?
I missed it, unfortunately, because I was a bit too patriotic. In fact, I was at the same time I was attending a press briefing, or rather a meeting between our president and Japanese businessmen. So I missed it, unfortunately. But I think the outcomes, it was successful, a successful summit. I think also for the South African delegation, they felt definitely it was a very fruitful occasion.
It was also good to see that some of the grouping, the top 20 grouping, they stood ground and then they pushed back against Trump's attempt to undermine an international effort to to fight climate change. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all signed they all signed that joint statement, which is good to see.
Mm-hmm. But wasn't it in the same week that we had news that China is opening a coal-fired power station a week. But still, yeah, I hear what you're saying, and clearly there is there's a sort of broad international front against Trump. On the issues of the trade war, sometimes I find it a bit surprising in that I find that some of the countries which, for political reasons, oppose him and support China. While China at the same time has done massive harm to the manufacturing bases of countries around the world. So, again, with international relations, you'd feel there'd be, as there should be, they're not really friends or enemies, there's interests. And I trust what you say, Tiseso, is that the South African delegation, spoke up for South Africa's interests, and that our own manufacturing and our own economy, that that our interests are being put first before those of the geopolitical ambitions of world players like Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and the aforementioned Donald Trump. And one always hopes that in going into these international forums, that is the case. And unfortunately, there have been instances where one wonders to what extent local interests are being sacrificed in the interests international solidarity.
But I also think, Patrick, going into this, it was clear that, South Africa finds itself also in a very tricky position because, in as much as we are aligning ourselves more towards the East, the U.S. remains an important trading partner for South Africa. Over this weekend, what was clear as well is that Japan increasingly is going to become a key feature in our trade relations. Mm-hmm. Speaking to one of the special envoys, Phumzile Langeni, I mean, she was excited, at the fact that, at least 26% of our foreign direct investment, Japan accounts for that, and that's according to figures from the presidency. So it's significant. The East is significant, and I think South Africa just has to tread a delicate line.
Absolutely. Well, we recall the Jacob Zuma himself as president, 4 or 5 years ago, in Beijing, at the China Africa Forum, saying, "Look, we have our own interests, and Africa is increasingly asserting itself as." As a starter and perhaps still minor, but becoming more important, a manufacturing sector, and it's really important that that in choosing sides in this sort of international power play, that we really speak up for the interests of our people, and not just our governments, which like to cozy, but the people itself, and you see people. you know, losing their jobs in industries that are being laid to waste by cheap production chains around the world. And, you know, I think Zuma on that occasion was quite correct in saying, look, you know, we're not a colony. You know, and also in terms of the exports, obviously volumes of exports are important, but also important is the type of exports. You know, if we're just shipping iron ore, coal, and you know, and raw materials, sure, I guess there's nothing wrong with that. But we want to we want China and Russia and the United States, they have with AGOA to some extent, to open their markets to our manufactured goods. But getting back on that, what a pity to have missed Ivanka standing with world leaders.
The world leaders.
Yeah. For me, what stood out, I mean, apart from Ivanka, which is very, what stood out was the fact that I'm on the sidelines of that, you know, of that summit, Trump and, you know, and the Chinese president, they, you know, they took time, you know, to sit down and say, well, look, you know, the trade war, the stalemate, we need to do something about this, and we, you know, but you never know.
What active steps do they take? Some
of the steps that they have taken was that, you know, Trump is not going to, you know, impose any more levies. And in return, China is going to buy, you know, unspecified, but in Trump's way, tremendous amount of, you know, agricultural products.
Sounds like the Mexico border.
From the U.S. So then they are back on the table. They are talking. I mean, which is, you know, it's good for us. I mean, it's good for the rest of the world. I mean, those are the two biggest economies in the world. Yeah. So, I mean, that came out. But you never know. You never know with Trump. Trump is volatile. You know, talks can collapse anytime, like they did in May.
I was just going to say, I'd like to throw a word of cautionary. I mean, one of the London-based consultancies, I mean, they were actually very pessimistic, you know, by Monday already, and they were reminding us that at last year's G20 summit, you know, the two countries reached a truce, and hardly 6 months later, Trump imposed those tariffs. So I think, you know, heading into the next couple of months, heading into 2020, likely to be very interesting. And we could be surprised by sort of, you know, another development in the near future. So.
Yeah. I mean, on the back of that whole China thing, has everyone picked up what's going on in Hong Kong, the massive protests that we are seeing? Some of them are being likened to the Tiananmen Square kind of gatherings. Have you seen any of that?
I haven't been following it.
I mean, personally as well, I mean, the stuff that I, you know, I don't have an informed opinion on that, but, you know, it's interesting to see that, you know, Hong Kong, they can, you know, they can stand up and actually say, we want our voice heard. And you know, China seems to be taking this, you know, it seems to be rubbing China the wrong way. I mean, what do you think of?
Look, I mean, apparently at some point, you know, a quarter of the people in Hong Kong have been involved in these protests. But the big question is, why did the authorities allow that quite small group of protesters to break into the Legislative Council building? You know, a process that took more than an hour of battering, which was clearly a sort of bulletproof window there, so allowed them in, allowed them to trash the place, and one wonders, you know, is this part of a longer game of kind of winning over some elements of Hong Kong society by isolating the so-called radicals who've now turned to violence and seriously disruptive behavior, or the Chinese calculating that? Or is it, on the other hand, are they preparing some sort of clampdown? I mean, you mentioned Tiananmen. I mean, notably, what they didn't do is what they did at Tiananmen Square. So clearly there's a lot of pressure on China. You know, when Hong Kong moved back into Chinese control, the idea was that each of the two systems, the Hong Kong system and the China system, that they'd both change to sort of meet each other.
That's not going to happen.
But that's not going to happen. You know, the Chinese you know, all the news reports of these protests and the break-in at the Legislative Council on CNN, they were all blocked in China straight away. So no one in China officially sort of knows about them at all. And that's unfortunately how the Chinese Communist Party rules.
Yeah.
They don't allow a crack of light. Yeah. And I don't see them putting up with this in Hong Kong for that much longer myself.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some of the local news. We had in the, I suppose on the front page of the Business Day today, the EFF possibly going to try paralyze the Joburg and Tshwane municipalities.
It was always going to be a problematic relationship between the EFF and the DA. I mean, ideologically, they are far apart. I mean, we've always known that. And, you know, the only reason they got together was so that they can defeat the ANC, make sure the ANC is not in power.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is the result. I mean, this quasi coalition that, you know, it's basically collapsing. I mean, it's headed towards collapse. I mean, if you're not going to vote, you know, what is the result? The result is you've got paralysis basically. You stifle decision making, and this comes at the time when, you know, we saw the Auditor General last week saying how municipalities are doing so badly. It's an unforgiving spotlight on how bad things are. Yeah. And now you've got two of the biggest metros, two metros in, probably not the biggest, two metros in the economic hub of South Africa, and there's a chance that there's a prospect of, you know, stifled decision making, and this is where the money is made. This is where the economy is being pumped, and it's a worry. It's a worry. I don't know what's
Well, I mean, as you say, a very uneasy fit, the DA and EFF, and surely in the interests of the ratepayers and the residents of these two metros, surely a more logical fit is the DA and the ANC. Look, I know a lot of people are going to throw their hands up at that, but that surely is the more logical fit.
Yeah.
I mean, the DA, to a large extent, they'll deny it, is a bit of a sort of ANC light. You know, they're not that far apart. But what worries me in the EFF, EFF versus the DA, the residents, the ratepayers, seem absolutely secondary to any sort of consideration.
Mm.
And reading that story, and possibly there's an answer elsewhere, one can't really understand just why they've taken this decision.
Mm.
I see Sir Julius Malema says something about the DA not voting with the EFF.
Mm.
And but I always thought the EFF was the junior partner. And clearly doesn't want to, clearly asserting itself.
So Patrick, in the Business Day today, and I think you've been following it quite closely, we've got the public protector ruling, which is, they claim is biting Ramaphosa. Why is that?
Well, I guess, you know, others are calling it Ramaphosa's Nkandla.
Right.
You know, basically we had Thuli Madonsela come out with a Secure and Comfort report several years ago. Recommending certain remedial actions. The then president, Jacob Zuma, resisted that. The Constitutional Court stepped in and said, yes, that the findings of the public protector are binding. So what's good for Ramaphosa now, what's good for Zuma, should now be good for Mr. Ramaphosa. So Musi Maimane, of course, end of last year, really started all the trouble with his question about the 500,000 rand donation to the CR17 campaign. I mean, little could Maimane have known that he seems to have plunged us, and I'm not blaming him personally, but he seems to have plunged us into a massive constitutional crisis, because here we have a president who accepted around the world, accepted by the majority of the ANC delegates at NASREC in December 2017, a man who commands huge respect, and yet here he is on the receiving end of of a public protector finding in respect of his public enterprises minister Pravin Gordhan, which says, "Well, here you go. I found against you. I want remedial action." Of course, he's since gone to court and said that no timeline was specified, also no particular action was specified. And obviously they're hoping for a constitutional court ruling on Mkhwebane in respect to the Bancor, her Bancor report, which has been heavily criticized both by judges and in public and by the media. And that this in turn may lead to some sort of proceeding in Parliament whereby the public protector is unseated. Mm. Whatever way it turns out, it doesn't look good for our constitution. Yeah. That,
but could an argument be made that there is a political bent to this, the approach that the public protector is taking?
Look, you join the dots, and an animal called political interest seems to emerge. Mm. You know, perhaps you're joining the wrong dot to the wrong dot, but it's very difficult to escape that impression.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, Busisiwe Mkhwebane advocate says of Musi Maimane's complaint in respect to the 500,000 that there's nothing to stop her delving deeper into issues around this. She doesn't have to restrict herself to the particular complaint. She can go around and find other. And then when you look at the finding in respect to the Frieda dairy farm, she seemed to fall over herself to limit that in such a way that report now has also been called into question, also subject to be fair though,
I mean, I know there's a cloud hanging over our public protector. I mean, her competence has been questioned quite a lot, but you know, I still think that we still need to respect the office. We still need to respect the institution that she occupies, and if her investigation into Ramaphosa is warranted, and Ramaphosa himself has come out to say that yes, I inadvertently took money, inadvertently lied to Parliament. Mm. And she's investigating that. Mm. We shouldn't say, there's a sense that what she's doing, she's tainting our Messiah, she's tainting the she's tainting our the person who's supposed to save us from basically get us out of the hole. But if that person has done something wrong, he should be investigated by a person by Mkhwebane herself, because we should also go with the principle that innocent until proven guilty. Let's see what the court says about about her conduct with respect to Absa Bancor.
Absolutely, I'd agree with you there. I mean, but possibly. Possibly one should really come to the powers of the public protector. Does the public protector wield too much power in our constitutional setup? And it's not unusual in constitutions and deliberations and around constitutions that one moves sort of to one side and then to the other before finding what would be a proper balance.
Yeah.
Because it does seem... It does seem unusual that a person can make a complaint, that the complaint can be investigated, and that the refusal then to immediately comply with the findings in respect of that complaint puts you at variance with the Constitution, and liable to be removed from office. Mm. And you think, well, these are fairly easy, not easy, but they're fairly straightforward legal steps that can short-circuit months of elections and politics. And so I agree with you completely. You know, she is in the job and we have to respect the office, and it's an important part of the Constitution.
Yeah.
But should we be revisiting and possibly in future
but
cases?
It's going to be a messy battle for Parliament, though, because they've got to basically adjudicate that question of whether she wields too much power or whether her findings are necessarily binding as she has found.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely. What came out basically at on Monday, in our story on Monday, if you saw, she basically said that the president is failing to uphold the constitution. That's, you know, that's a pretty huge indictment on the president. Yeah, and you know, it's in the past. I think if it had Tuliman Madonsela said that, I think a lot of people would have been up in arms. I mean, there would have been an outrage. But because it's her, and she, she doesn't seem to hold that credibility. That she doesn't have that. What do you think, Asha?
No, I certainly think so. And I mean, I don't have an informed opinion from a political perspective. But I mean, just. It's clear that there is in the court of public opinion, she doesn't hold much sway.
Yeah.
And one can even see that. I mean, just in the engagements with the business community, with the president himself. We often had a business community at odds with the former administration and the former president, where you can see sort of more or less now they move in sync, and definitely I think that she's just going to have a difficult time actually elevating or rubber stamping her authority. It'll be interesting to see how long she survives.
And just to add to that, it's not just the court of public opinion. It's in the courts. I mean, the courts have found big problems with her Bancorp finding, her remedial action to change the constitution, to change the mandate to the Reserve Bank. Her Frieda Dairy report, also up in contention in the courts and being heavily criticized by the courts themselves.
All right, I want to move on quickly to the portfolio committees that we had. I think the chairs were elected, I think, last week, if I'm not mistaken. But we have a story here that Mutambi rubbishes the idea that any of these committees are captured or former Zuma loyalists. You got a smoke on your face.
No, look, I mean, it's very difficult to believe what she's saying, that, none of the committees, I mean, if she has it, and that it's not captured, it's very hard to believe. I mean, she made a mess at the SABC. We've heard, testimony from the state capture commission as to how bad things were, and then how how she took instructions from some of the former president Zuma friends, the Guptas.
With the election of these various chairs, is it a sign that Ace Magashule is indeed getting his way, Patrick?
That seems to be. We carried a report in the Sunday Times, I think 3 weeks ago, about the caucus meeting on the Thursday being cancelled, where all of these, I call them the Zuma shadow cabinet, where that was all stopped. But obviously, the ANC is a big party with many competing interests, and clearly there are factions, and clearly the Ramaphosa faction isn't always going to get its way. Ace, he seems to have a sort of constituency and in the ANC and wields considerable power. So, he's flexed his muscles a little bit. And he's... He's kind of said, look, it's not going to go... It's not going to go all your way.
Just touching some company news. We had Truett. Slump says the venture in the UK faces a big debt repayment. It's not the first one to get burnt over.
No, definitely, Smay. It's a huge problem, basically, because particularly for shareholders. I mean, from the start, it was odd that they would choose to go to the UK, where retailers are already facing competition from nimble competitors like your e-commerce giant like e-commerce, so like Amazon, for example. So why would you go there when you've got growth you know, in your backyard in Africa, you know, you've got, I mean, if you see some of the sales figures from the likes of ShopRite and Massmart from outside of South Africa, elsewhere in Africa, you see that, you know, there is growth there, but yes, it's not easy to turn that into profit. But in the long run, that's where money is, that's where growth is, that's where people, you know, are going to continue buying. The middle class is growing. The economies are growing much faster than they are in the UK. I find it very hard. I found it very odd that they chose to go there. But as you say, they are not the first one. There's been plenty, actually. Yeah.
You suspect the bosses want offices in London rather than in Dar es Salaam or in Abuja.
I mean, you would think so. I mean, because most probably, if you will find a better, you know, a better hotel in London than you would in Abuja.
Let's leave it there. That is it for this week's edition of Editing Aloud. Do join us again next week. Goodbye.